Hi, Newt's World podcast listeners. Lisa Booth here. I'm part of the Gingrich 360 podcast network. Newt is out this week finishing his new book, Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. So he asked me to take this opportunity to fill in for him by introducing one of my most recent podcast episodes for my podcast, The Truth with Lisa Booth. New episodes of The Truth with Lisa Booth come out every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now here's The Truth with Lisa Booth, an episode I did with the Academy Award-winning actor, John Voight. I hope you love it. And check out Newt's new book, Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. It's available right now for pre-order on Amazon.
America is losing its way, not because of the people who just want what's best for their country, they just want what's best for their families, but because of the radical leftists overtaking our culture and the cowardly elites wielding too much power that are trying to drive this country apart. Simply put, America needs to recover its values, recover a traditional way of life. This is The Truth with Lisa Booth. Welcome back to The Truth with Lisa Booth. I've got a tremendous show for you guys this week. I am so, so excited about it because my guest is the one and only John Voight, Academy Award winning actor, all around amazing guy, great patriot as well. He's been an outspoken conservative, unafraid to buck the far left Hollywood establishment. He's a wonderful storyteller. He's always entertaining, always insightful. And today I ask him about his upbringing, his career, how he got into acting, and of course, the state of our country. With that, I want to welcome the great John Voight to The Truth with Lisa Booth. Mr. Voight, it is my honor, it is my pleasure to speak with you.
Well, Lisa, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I've been impressed with you, you know, down through the years, even saw you on the set and expressed my appreciation of what you do. And it's good to talk to you.
Thank you. And just so for everyone to know, so I met Mr. Voight on set when I was guest co-hosting on Fox and Friends, and you were so kind and so humble and just exceptionally kind. That was something that really stood out to me after meeting you, just how nice you were to everyone and including myself.
Oh, isn't that nice? Well, that, good for me.
Yes, good for me too. Me too. It's much better than the alternative, right?
You bet. Listen, it's nice to be on the Fox channel when I am. And I pay attention to it. And I've watched your work over the years now, a couple of years, and you're just terrific. So it's always nice to see your face and your presence on the various shows that you do.
Well, thank you, sir. That's a huge honor and huge compliment coming from you. So I really appreciate it. You know, and sir, I think sometimes, I mean, look, you're a huge Hollywood star. You have had an incredibly long career, an incredibly successful career. And so I think sometimes when someone has been out in the public so long, they kind of forget, who is John Voight? Like, what was your childhood like growing up? Tell us a little bit about your upbringing.
I will. I was just going to say, life is very short. People say that all the time to the little kids. And the little kids are thinking, oh, my God, it's going to be so long before I get to be 18. Or, they want so much to advance and grow and all of that. And life is very short. And a career is very short. And at one point, some young lady asked me, who was Cary Grant? And I couldn't believe that I was listening to this, because in my lifetime, he was, such a splendid part of our lives, watching his great movies. And I couldn't believe that kids didn't know him, And I'm like that now. I'm getting older. And so the new ones are coming forth. And it's just interesting to look back on different things. Anyway, I've forgotten the question.
No, what was your childhood like growing up? What were your parents like?
Yeah. So my childhood, I grew up in Yonkers, New York, and I had two brothers. We were a threesome. We were only a year apart, and I was in the middle. And from the earliest time, we were all a rambunctious, very active three kids, and each one of us went our different ways. My younger brother became enamored of music, and went on to be a singer-songwriter, and he wrote "Wild Thing" and "Angel of the Morning" and many, many great hits. and he's still writing today. And he's a wonderful. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame and stuff. And my older brother Barry was always, when he was a young fellow, was out with his uncle, who had come back from the service. This was in the 40s. And he would go on camping trips and stuff. And he was very interested in nature. And he would take photographs of the natural world and different animals and stuff. And he became a geologist and a well-known volcanologist, a volcano expert. And he's been feted and put into entered a major society, you know, scientific society, a very elite society. And all of that, you know, so the kid, we each of us in our childhood gave evidence of what we wanted to be. And we were given encouragement as kids to follow, you know, whatever, wherever our loves took us. And I, as a kid, was very playful. I was kind of the glue in the family, in a certain sense, with the children, because I'd kind of negotiate between my two brothers, who were both very fierce energies. And we had a lot of fun, and I was playful, and I would make up games to play. And I would, when television came along in the 50s, I started watching a Saturday night show, hour and a half show called The Show of Shows, Your Show of Shows. And it starred Sid Caesar and Imogen Coca and Carl Reiner and Howard Marks, those four. And it was written, this show was very popular at that time, and it was written by Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, Neil Simon, all of the great comedy writers were part of that show. And so I had a very, I didn't know it at the time, but I was being influenced by really brilliant people in the entertainment world. And I used to imitate this fellow Sid Caesar a lot, for the entertainment of my classmates. And that became, as I look back, I said, wait a minute, I think I probably got more out of that than I did in all the other years. I certainly learned from many, many people on the way up. But that initial signature was stayed with me. So, because he was a character comedy actor, right? And I became a character actor. I was interested in different kinds of characters and different accents and different behaviors. And that examination into those areas of acting, as to opposed to the leading man kind of actor, who I have great appreciation for, guys who are pretty much the same in every film and just know how to do that kind of work and are very charismatic. And I went off into this other world of character acting and was influenced by many people growing into it, you know, and working with great people like Dustin Hoffman and others, you know.
And so how did you get into it? Because, you know, acting in Hollywood's obviously an incredibly hard career to sort of get your foot in the door. How did you do it?
Well, it was a long process for me. No one in my family had any connection to acting or, you know, entertainment. My dad was a golf professional, and he was, and I have to say, just take a word about my father, was a remarkable guy. He loved golf. He was a great golf professional, and he had a terrible accident when he was 18 years old, and he wasn't able to pursue. It created a spinal, the accident that was happening coming from a golf tournament in Chicago, and the result of the injury that he had created calcium deposits in his spine, and he wasn't able to be as flexible, and he wasn't able to play golf on the tour. So he lost the great love of his life, really. But he became a great teacher of golf, and we, as his children, gained a father at home. He wasn't away in the golf tournaments and with the lures of all of that. He was a great father, and he was a great storyteller. And I don't know to this day how he became such a good storyteller, because he came from immigrant parents. His father couldn't speak very good English, never did pick up the language too well, but was really, really charming and funny, a good fellow. But my dad, with the help, I think, of the members of the club, it was a German-Jewish country club. The people couldn't get into other country clubs because they were Jewish, so they built their own club. And my dad was the beneficiary of that and our family. And I think he probably learned storytelling from those members as he was caddying when he was a very young boy. And the stories he told us at bedtime for several years in our growing up were very key to us growing properly and to our enjoyment of things and insights into things, because he would always put little messages into the stories and stuff. And whenever you get into that phase of it, he'd go, "Well, you know, boys, you've got to, you know that you won't be able to run as fast always, and you won't be able to, and so you have to." And we'd say, "Tell the story, Dad. Get back to the story. Get back to the story." We were very impatient. We didn't want him to tell us, but the messages hit home, I think. And because of that man, you know, a lot, I have to give my father and mother great credit for whatever good I have in my personality today. But anyway, so we grew up in that kind of an atmosphere when I was young. And I got caught, as I say, with this imitating and being playful and all of that stuff. And I never thought I would go into it. I never, you know, it was a very interesting journey that I took. But at the end of my college career, my junior year of college, right before I went into my senior year of college, and I was at college at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., which had a very good drama department, but I was in the art department because I thought I could get more attention to other things. I was very active let's say, the politics, but also just the social life of the university. And that was very good training for me, I must say. I enjoyed that, and I grew from it. But I kept asking people what I should do. What do you think I should do? You know, should I be a lawyer? Should I? And I thought about, you know, maybe a politician, maybe a teacher. I'd be a good teacher. Things like that. And then I was walking around campus with a book, and I looked down at one point, and I saw this book, and I said, "What am I doing with this book?" And I, of course, I knew what I was doing with the book, but it was a book of criticisms of stage work in the golden age of the British theater with Laurence Olivier and Ralph Richardson and John Gielgud and those fellows. And it was by Kenneth Tynan, the leading critic of that time. And he gave very elaborate descriptions of the different performances and their effects. And I underlined and made notes on all of Laurence Olivier's performances. The rest of it I wasn't so interested in, but in his performances, I saw something about how he approached the character that he was playing and how his choices in building a character made a difference in the impact of the play. I somehow understood that. Maybe I got it from my father and the way he told stories because I ingested all of that understanding. And then maybe just there was a talent there for me. I saw something. I saw how you affect a story. So you grab the attention of the people and you move them, this kind of thing. And I looked at that and I said, I think I even verbally said this out loud. I was alone on campus looking at this book. And I said, "I know what I want to do. I want to be him." And I pointed to, you know, something of Olivier's, you know. So that epiphany that happened right there, that was it. I knew I was going to graduate after this senior year, and I was going to go on to New York, and I was going to study. And I knew in my mind at that time, these are the things that I remember very vividly, you know. I said, I know I'm not going to give up. I'm going to do it. I'm going to be a success. In other words, I knew it was going to be challenging. I knew I was going to go ups and downs, but I knew I'd stick with it, and I knew I'd be okay. but nobody else did. Certainly your parents don't. When you're going towards such a shaky career, you know, you don't know if your child is going to be able to make a living.
Sir, just one moment. We have to take a quick break and then we'll get right back to it.
The notion that police are racist who kill Black Americans disproportionately is a lie. A mirage, an optical illusion not supported by any of the facts. It's a false narrative. This week on The Truth with Lisa Booth, I cut through the noise to get to the truth about race and policing in America with Heather McDonald, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The War on Cops. We get to the bottom of this anti-police narrative and the impact it's having on our country. You don't want to miss this episode. And make sure you listen to The Truth with Lisa Booth every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, you hear about the Hollywood industry. I mean, you're out at castings. It's hard to get in the door. And you read stories about people getting
How
their
do
start.
You know that, but that's exactly.
Well, I have family in the industry, but I've also. You know, you read about different people's stories, like Sylvester Stallone's stories always stood out to me as well, and sort of his hustle and getting, Rocky started. But, you know, how did you persevere? Like, what was that, just trying to get your feet in the door? What was that like for you, of just trying to get that first gig, that first opportunity, that first ability to show what you had to offer? What was that like for you?
Well, when you start out, you certainly don't have a lot of experience to tell you who you are and what you do. Do you see? So you have to gain some experience, and you have to. And I looked for a teacher right away in New York, got a little apartment in New York with two other guys. Thankfully, they were almost never there, so I had the place to myself. It was a little bare apartment, and there was a great Greek restaurant, a cafeteria downstairs, which was very reasonable and kept me alive. But I went to classes. I talked to actors. I took an opportunity to try out for everything, all of that stuff, right? Didn't have much success in the beginning. And long periods of drought. And I finally got an acting coach, and he wasn't good. I turned out to be very bad. I wasn't learning anything. I was actually going backward. And then finally I got a teacher who was one of the great teachers of that time, Sanford Meisner and Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg were the three great teachers of that time that you were fortunate if you had any contact with. So I learned a basic kind of basic for the craft, and of course I had something in me that was I knew about entertainment. I could entertain people. I did have abilities that I knew, but how they applied in the real world I didn't know. So I worked very hard, and then when I got through that, and I had a little jobs too. Always I got a little job, and I got a little job on Broadway actually. With very early on playing the telegraph boy in Sound of Music, Ralph, the fellow who turns the family in. So I had some success. I knew I had something, and that kept me going. And then finally, after I finished a couple of years with Mr. Meisner, I was looking to get a job that would show off these talents that I had. And I finally got A View from the Bridge, which is an Arthur Miller play. It was the first production of the long version of that play. And it's a very great play, I have to say. And I got that role, and I worked with Bobby Duvall. And it just happened that Bobby Duvall was good friends with Dustin Hoffman. And Dusty was also connected to this director, Ulla Grossbart, and he showed up to help out with the directing of the piece. So I met Dustin Hoffman, in that time, and he saw me do some very good work. That was the first time that I realized that I had achieved something in the classwork, and that I had found some ground, you know. And it was like a base to fly from, in a way. I experienced a lot of things in that particular time period where I learned about myself. I was very entertaining in the character. I think I was, and I was very moving and powerful as well. So it was a great role and a role that was fit to me. And I made a mark. And therefore, I had, a step up now. People were going to be looking at me, and that's what happened.
And you've been in a ton of successful films, you know, starting with, you know, Midnight Cowboy, that was a big break for you, to even more recently winning a Golden Globe for the television series Ray Donovan. Why do you think you've been able to have such a long and sustained career when so many haven't been able to do that?
First of all, good fortune. I think, you know, I was lucky. But also, there's a little bit of a mystery to me, and it's a spiritual aspect. I was in bad behavior, as I look back, and things happened to me where I changed my perspective on things, and I was lifted from that. I was able to get away from that, and I became very connected. Although I grew up a Catholic, and when I hit New York, I kind of lost that, you know, I kind of left that behind and got in trouble with it, you know, got away from this understanding of God and the rules of life and stuff. And even the examples of my parents, who were admirable people, I lost my way a little bit. And then I came back around. And because of that, I turned into a person who was devoted to God and did a lot of meditation, and I was able to change. And in that change, many things happened. I have some stories to tell about the mysteries of that, but I would say that's the mark that kept me going, giving me a lift when I was very down. I said prayers, and the prayers were answered in many ways. So I'd say there's a spiritual aspect.
And you talk about God a lot. And, you know, right now in the country, we're seeing a decline in religious affiliation over the past few years. Do you think that's why we're having so many problems as a country right now?
Well, I would say yes. We've lost our moorings, you know. The stuff that they're feeding our children right now is very disturbing. There used to be I remember there's a book, Everything That You Need to Know You Were Learned in Kindergarten, you know, and that was a good book because it showed you how much morality and real basics for life were taught in kindergarten. Taking responsibility for yourself and all sorts of things. And we've gotten, and now the children are being given poison from all of these woke teachings, I have to say. And we've let our guard slip, and we have to recapture that ground. Otherwise, we're a doomed society. And I feel that we're starting to understand that too. And that's why the last video that I released was very strong. And I have help to get these videos done, you know, to do these videos. But perhaps I'd read it to you, and we can talk about it.
Yeah. What concerns you right now the most in taking a look at the country? You're talking about. I watch the videos that you do. I know that you tweet them out as well, sir. And you're a very vocal conservative. What, taking a look at where we are right now as a nation, what concerns you the most?
What concerns me the most is that we've lost our moorings and we're being overtaken by really it's an evil that is trying to overtake this country and all the greatness of this country. Why is it that people want to come to this country? Why is it that people are breaking down, you know, our borders to get to us? And why is it that the people who are most concerned about us are people from who have lived under this this tyranny of socialism, communism, you know, across the world. People from Poland, people from Russia, people from Cuba. We're turning into a Venezuela, and they see it. They can see it clearly because it happened to them. They went through all of this horror and sadness and lost their countries. And they see the same thing happen to the United States. And this was the place that they came to because they needed to get to a safe shore. They needed to get to freedom. They needed to get to opportunity. And now they see that this country too is falling under this evil influence, and so that's my concern at this time. I think we all have to be very, very concerned, and therefore, I do everything I can, because I've gone through a lot of this myself from the 60s, and I see how it's happened. And I know that the people must be courageous and learned and fight this battle for our future generations. We have to stand up here. This is it.
That's such an interesting point, Mr. Voigt. Hold that thought right there. We have to take a break.
The notion that police are racist who kill Black Americans disproportionately is a lie. A mirage, an optical illusion not supported by any of the facts. It's a false narrative. This week on The Truth with Lisa Booth, I cut through the noise to get to the truth about race and policing in America with Heather McDonald, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The War on Cops. We get to the bottom of this anti-police narrative and the impact it's having on our country. You don't want to miss this episode. And make sure you listen to The Truth with Lisa Booth every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have a fundamental respect for people that go their own way. You know, it's so easy to follow the crowd. It's so easy to follow a group. It's much harder to stand alone in your convictions and in your strength and what you believe. And that is what you do. You're exceptionally brave, particularly in an industry that doesn't really care for, you know, different diversity and ideology. How has it been like for you as a conservative in an industry that typically seems to all be on, you know, one side of the aisle? Has that been hard?
It's going to be difficult. It's costing you work, of course, because people are afraid to, the people who would have common sense are afraid to be exposed for having common sense. Can you imagine? That's what's going on. Yeah, it's really nuts. So I'm a person that everyone, thank God that I've had some success in my life so that people know that, you know, when they hire me, I'm going to give a good representation of the work and maybe make their piece more successful. And all of that, but people are afraid to be exposed at this time for questioning this this bad behavior that's going on all over the place. But it's interesting. It's a battle. And it's in this industry. You see, initially, the KGB targeted the United States, and Khrushchev said, "You know, we'll overcome you, but we won't do it with guns. You know, we'll just you'll vote us into office." That's what he said. You know, and that's pretty much what's happened. I mean, they know what they're doing. They targeted the film industry because of its influence. They targeted schools. And because we're a country of freedom of speech, they used it as a tool for themselves. They took advantage of it, and we didn't see it coming. So there's an awful lot to be said about this, of course. And they're smarter people than I, too.
Well, and I work in the media, sir, and, you know, I see, you know, fortunately, I work for a network that really tries to get both sides of the aisle when you look at other networks that do not, like CNN and MSNBC. But I see how, you know, a lot of the mainstream media really pushes the left's propaganda. What role do you think Hollywood plays in that as well?
Well, I think it's a very big surprise that the media can be so captured, so overtaken. How could this be? Don't journalists have any sense of pride even, you know? Don't they? But, you know, they're low on the totem pole, so they keep their mouths shut and they just do their jobs. You see, they repeat the party line. This is just like Russia. I mean, this is just like Pravda. There's no different. You read the New York Times, you're getting phony stuff. So what does a guy do who wants to feed his family and he needs to keep his job? It's those pressures that keep it going, I think. So who's going to stop this? Well, there are many brave people that are stepping up, and great brave teachers who are in the industry, the entertainment industry, and in the news industry, that are stepping up and giving us a direction. So we have to find those people and stick with them and support them.
What was it about conservatism? You know, when did you become a conservative, and what convinced you? You talked about your journey with religion. What was your journey like in politics?
My journey in politics was that I was susceptible to being in the 60s. I was just learning to, going to school to learn to act, wanting to be one of those actors that works all the time, you know, needing to have success, and trying to find roles, trying to find all of this stuff. And I was available to all of the politics of that time, which was anarchism took place in the streets of the United States. You know, there was a lot of things going on. And I, when I look back, I say, well, what happened was, it's really, really from the trauma of losing John Kennedy. I was a big supporter of Kennedy. I was infatuated with Kennedy. He was very, he seemed like the answer to many things. He was very idealistic, and he had this nice way about him, and I believed in it. And then, and the country did too. And suddenly he was murdered. And I think everyone was hurt by that. When we talk about trauma, I think everybody knew where they were when they heard that news. I think the fact is that nobody really could figure out what exactly happened to this day. And after that, things became, we had no leadership from the top. That's what I felt. Not leadership we believed in. And that's my personal, everyone knows where they were at the time they heard that news. And so I would say that was a big blow. And in moved all of this leftism, some from the people in the streets who were just advocating free love and this and, you know, all that stuff. But that was also planted by very clever people from the left, which means the communists and the Russian KGB, the German group, the Frankfurt School, came in. They were on the left. And so all of these distortions that took place were manipulated. And that was the beginning. Now, since that time, we had one break where we had President Reagan, and things were more clear and different and better. But it didn't last very long. And we took our eye, especially when the Soviet Union collapsed, we felt we had no enemies anymore. And we took our eye off the ball. And that's when they moved in. That's when the forces that they had started in the 60s moved into our schools, our education. So they had been moving into the education system and took over our industry and took over the media. So and we can you can chart that out. You can see the heroes and villains in that process. But that's where we are now. We're really facing a takeover.
Well, and there's just such censorship. I mean, you talked about tyranny earlier. I mean, we look at the fact that the president, the former president of the United States, was banned from social media. We have big tech actively taking a role in silencing or suppressing information. I mean, even today, if you try questioning the 2020 election, despite the fact that Democrats lied about the 2016 election for years, if you try questioning an election where we had an unprecedented amount of mail-in ballots in the middle of a pandemic, you know, you get meted as some sort of conspiracy theorist. Why do you think that is? Why can't we question the results of the 2020 election?
Well, this has been watching Donald Trump has been very interesting because who is Donald Trump? Donald Trump is a fellow who is very, very successful, has many gifts, obvious gifts prior to becoming president, right? Certainly got to work with, you know, many different aspects of our society to put up the beautiful buildings that he has, you know, gotten accomplished. It's changed the skyline you know, New York City and the world, really. Many, many different buildings across the world. So, and he's used to working with all sorts of different things, you know. In order to get permissions, you have to work with different city councils and all sorts of stuff, and architects and building materials. You have to budget stuff. And he has a tremendous arsenal of talents that he's been, you know, culling over the years, and then he becomes president of the United States. Now he becomes president of the United States, and people didn't know where he was going to go. If you remember, they didn't know whether he was going to be conservative or whether he was too much on the left because he'd been, you know, he's been friends with Hillary Clinton for, you know, put money into this and that. And then all of a sudden he starts, but somebody knew because before he was before he was actually sworn in, they said they're going to impeach him, didn't they? The left and the Democrat Party knew he was dangerous to them. Because why? Why? He hadn't done anything yet. Part of it was because he didn't have any respect for the swamp, you know, the way things go. He wasn't, you couldn't corrupt him. You couldn't buy him. Oh, wow, that's tough. You see? But how did they see the power that he was? And it's very interesting. They went after him with everything they had right from the beginning. And he was very friendly to many of these people who were leadership in the Democrat Party. So something's way off, you see. They knew somehow that he was going to be dangerous to them. And in fact, he was, because he's a good, God-fearing man who has a great talent for leadership. And he was going to go in and he said, I'm going to clean this up a little bit. And he did. Everything he said, he did. And perhaps it was the promises he made as he grew toward the election that he said he was going to do this, put the wall at the border, take on the challenge of China, redo the trade, all of these things that he said he was going to do, he actually did. The most amazing thing, because no one has ever done so much in such a short period of time. And when you think that he was attacked every day that he was in office, it's unbelievable.
But what do you think happened? Because you've said before, you know, you're disgusted with the lie that Biden has been chosen as if we all don't know the truth. What do you think the truth is about the 2020 election?
Oh, well, I mean, I think you said it. I mean, there's so much evidence that it was a stolen election. I take this back to the moment when Soros realized that Trump had been elected by the American people. And he said, this is a disaster. And he meant it. And Soros is a very interesting character, and he represents all of the stuff that's going on. He's anti-Trump in every way. And he was not, and he's, he uses all his billions to infiltrate into the schools with all his foundations and all his organizations, all misnomered, by the way, because they all represent themselves as being patriotic, and they're not, looking at the Constitution, and then it really is an attack on the Constitution, and that's given to the kids in colleges. I mean, he's really a supporter of everything anti-American. So anyway, that when he said that, it was like saying, okay, he threw down the gauntlet. He's never going to let this happen again. And it was he and the Democrat leadership and all of the people on the left who gathered together to stop this man and to make sure that this next election would not repeat itself. And, of course, they had a big problem because Donald Trump gave us the best economy we've ever had. And he was doing all sorts of things, that we dreamed would be accomplished, that needed so badly to be done. We were seeing the country go downhill, and all of a sudden this man comes up and has insights in almost every area of the problem and corrects it as he goes. Well, quite something. And they were going to bring him down. So they gathered every force they could and tried every deceitful, method to attack him and slander him. And they still couldn't do it until COVID. And so you have to question that too. But then coming down to the election, they weren't going to let this happen. They just weren't going to let it happen. So you get all of these things about, weakening all the ability for people to make a proper vote and be properly counted. And that's what they did all across the country. And they used every method and they encouraged every kind of bad behavior. And those blackouts, those several hour blackouts in the main states, unbelievable. And it turned the tide. So, yeah, I think we have to pay very close attention to it. And hopefully, the truth will emerge and we'll catch these people who this is real criminal behavior of the highest order.
Do you think President Trump should run again, or who do you think, who are you looking at as the future of the Republican Party?
Well, I think we have many great people, actually. We should take heart that we have many great people in the Republican Party who have stepped up, who have gone through this, standing tall. I can name, dozens, and that's good. But right now, I'm watching President Trump to see what he's going to do. I think we have to just wait and see. There obviously are other people who can run and be successful, and I think the country will show itself next November in a very strong way. But I'm watching President Trump. He still has enormous influence. People love this man for what he has done and for the way he handles himself.
How much, you mentioned the next election, which I think is probably one of the most consequential elections we've ever had in American history. Personally, I think it's going to determine if we become, a communist authoritarian type nation or a nation that is still a republic that still believes in the foundings of our country. How much of a referendum do you think it'll be on the Biden administration?
Well, of course it's going to be. Then again, you're going to look to the polls to see if you have the ability. And the Biden administration is changing everything. They're doing a lot of damage on a daily basis. And they're trying to, and the Democrat Party is trying to overthrow all of the constitutional strengths of our country. Let me read, because a lot of people haven't seen that video. Let me read the words right now. Biden, these are the words, Biden has taken all Trump's works and switched to Obama's carefully instructed instructions. This nation is in complete chaos. Let us pray for a moment. Let us bless this nation for a moment. My dear friends, my fellow Americans, Donald J. Trump was our savior. This new administration has turned us upside down with deceit and destruction. We're all in the same frame of mind, hoping, praying for God's miracle, a miracle that can cross us over like the parting of the sea. Jesus spoke. Moses spoke. Let God speak. Let God heal all our suffering souls, and let President Trump feel this, because he was truly following God's call, not the swamp that destroys. I want to get to the end of it because it's very important. President Trump had a gift for all people, all nations. He loved this country, and he did save it until the left wing distorted all his work and turned it into their deceit. We, the people who have faith, we, the people that love our country, the USA, we all must focus on what is truly truths. What and who has our best interest? Be aware, my fellow Americans, the Biden administration has destroyed our nation. But my friends, God has a plan. He will show that truths will win. No man can lie, steal, or take away the one truth, and that is the power of God, the power of righteousness, the power of Abraham Lincoln's work, the note he left for his nation, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth.
I really do think, we had talked about earlier about sort of looking at God and family, and I think that's part of the reason why the left tends to de-emphasize religion. They tend to de-emphasize family, is because if you're rooted in these things that are deeper and more important than government, you're not looking to government. I mean, they really want a population that is completely dependent on the government, that's dependent on them, that doesn't have, that aren't rooted in core convictions like family and religion, it seems.
Nonsense, the COVID stuff, stay in your house, do this, do that, wear your mask, wear three masks, what are you doing? They spend their time with that. They don't spend their time solving anything. They have no understanding of governance. Certainly, they have no understanding of the economy. I mean, this is a long story with communism. When Lenin took over in Russia, the Bolsheviks, after 4 years, he killed 4 million people, starved more 4 million people to death. And 10 years later, over 5 million people were starved by Joseph Stalin. I was there in the early 90s, 1991, and I was witness to the misery that the people lived under. And this is what we're voting in now? We've got to stop this. We've got to know that we have a great country with a tremendous set of principles and instructions. We have to get back to it, to our happiness. We're suffering right now, and we have to prevail. The truth has to prevail now. We have to stand up.
Do you think that's why? I mean, Martin Luther King said that he wanted his kids to grow up in a nation that they were judged on the content of their character versus the color of their skin. But it seems like the left is pushing this idea that everyone views each other from a racial prism as a prism versus just looking at each other as human beings or fellow Americans. Why do you think we've arrived at this point of such racial division?
Yeah, well, it's been inserted into our country because of it. All of this stuff, the gender stuff, that came with the Frankfurt School. We've been invaded. We got to know where this came from and reveal it to folks. this whole nonsense of diversity training programs that are not about racial sensitivity. They're about demonizing white people now and the constitutional order of individual freedom, equality, and accountability that the American founders created. Dressing up a racial attack, like this, and demand for conformity as racial sensitivity toward minorities is perhaps, it's the only way such an anti-democratic set of ideas could possibly be imposed on the American mind. But then, anyway, we're dealing with real bad stuff here, bad thinking.
What's the path forward? Because you've been a student of this, you've paid a lot of attention over the years, which is obvious in my conversation with you. What's your hope for America? What's your hope for the future?
I say righteousness is not dead. God has not left his chair. I say it's not just going to church. It's not understanding that we're here for what? What is a life worth? What is a life? We have to ask that question. Our lives are giving us an opportunity to grow, to learn lessons, to grow strong, to help, to look to other people. What is the basic golden rule? Do unto others. Well, all of that is missing now. It's not do unto others has another meaning now. Do it to your enemy. Do it to the masses. It's this totalitarian thing that the American founders put behind us, put behind the world. We were the Declaration of Independence. These words in the Declaration of Independence changed 3,000 years of tyranny. We brought forth government by the people, in a very beautiful, very considered way. These instructions that are in our Constitution are golden, and we changed the world what we thought forever. But now we're being pulled back. So anyway, the answer is that God is real, and we have to be our better selves, and we have to stand now for our children and the future children.
And what's next for you? You've accomplished a tremendous amount in your life. What do you want to do? What's next for you?
Oh, well, I'm 82 years old, and I'm still very, very active, and I'm in pretty good health, and I still love acting. So I'll still do my work as an actor, the best I can. I probably never get, somebody asked me if I would retire. I said, no, I don't think I'm going to retire. As long as I can still play something, I'll be available. But the idea for me is I'm looking after this country the best I can. I feel so much my citizenship to this country. I'm so proud to be an American patriot, and to understand what was given to us, and to find myself allied with the great people of our history, all those wonderful people who have been given memorials in D.C. They're great, great people. All those words on the walls, I understand them. And so I'll carry on the best I can to see if I can do everything I can before I have to leave.
Well, sir, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you. You are an incredibly talented actor. You are a patriot, and hopefully now I can call you a friend. It's been such an honor to have this conversation with you, and I so appreciate your time. It means the world to me.
Great. Well, this is my pleasure to be with you. I didn't find this in this conversation as much as I'd like about you.
What would you like to ask before we go?
I'd really like to know what your parents were like, what your siblings were like. How did you grow up? Because you, at a very early age, have got so much clarity and so much drive. It's wonderful.
I so appreciate that. Thank you, sir. I grew up, my parents are very religious. They're Christians. They believe in God. So they taught us belief in God taught us to, you know, to respect others, to be kind to others, to, you know, try to practice what you preach. I grew up, you know, similar to what you were talking about with your dad, you know, my parents have always been those people that, you know, no matter what you want to do in life, we support you. And there's even been times where, you know, I've left jobs, I took a gamble, you know, I left a great job to take a gamble on TV to see if I could, you know, get a contract and make it work. And I, you know, didn't really have a plan in place. It was sort of it was sort of something that just came up and it arised and I had to make a decision. And my parents were fully supportive of it because they knew I loved television. They knew that was my dream. So I was very blessed like you to have parents that were just very supportive and, you know, were there, loved unconditionally, supportive no matter what, always there to pick you up. And which is why I believe that family nucleus is everything in life. And I grew up with three brothers. So I had an older brother who, you know, says that he made me tough, you know, practicing, you know, wrestling moves and, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, so I grew up in an environment where family is everything, you know, and especially I'm sure you feel this way, you know, working in Hollywood and working in acting. You know, look, media is a fickle beast, right? So it's, you know, things are going great today and I'm fortunate for that. And I've worked hard and I'm blessed to have what I have for now, but it could go away tomorrow. And so if that happens, what are you left with? And what really matters in life? And, you know, it's friends, it's family, it's the people around you. It's the things that are so much more important than work or money or any of this other stuff. So I try to keep that in the back of my mind too, in an industry that I know is so fickle, so up and down. And you never know where it's going to end up, you know, even a week from now.
Well, you're doing very, very well. You're blessed to have great gifts, you know, so, and you're using them wisely. So I'm excited about what's going to happen to you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Lise.
It's been an honor. You're the best. I appreciate your time.
God bless. Bye-bye, Donna.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you loved it. New episodes of The Truth with Lisa Booth come out every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen and subscribe for free. Also, just wanted to say happy Father's Day to all the hardworking dads out there and happy Father's Day to my dad, Jeff. I love you so much.